Heavenly Father, we're gathered here together to help each other. We know that without thy help, we'd be of no use. That the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be accepted on thy side. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. I'm no set. What? And I know I always will be, but it doesn't have to worry or disturb me. As long as I don't take that first drink, I'll be all right. Now I'm teaching taking that first drink, there's a few things that I ought to do. One of them is what I'm doing now, which I've always hated to do. I can't make notes, and there's so many such good talkers and brilliant speakers with wonderful vocabulary, none of these I have. But you know, what I do say to you, I mean it from the bottom of my heart, and I think that's pretty important too. Guys, can you hear me back there?
Okay.
Yeah. I said I thought long and loud. I was the oldest of a family of seven, a very poor family. I had none of the advantages that young folks look forward to having and do appreciate having, because we were poor, and what we did have, my father drank heavily. I think he was an alcoholic. We don't say that because we can't say to the other person, but I know I was deprived a great deal through his drinking. And I hated booze, and I certainly never thought I'd drink any. But that's something else we don't know. So when I was 16, I was invited to come and live with an aunt in Indiana. And I went out there, and she told me right from the start she had a nice home, and I could have the advantages that I hadn't had before. But she told me that I could have company, I could date, but there were two fellows there in town that she didn't want me to date. Just because they drank too much. And she went on to explain to me that this Macy came from one of the best families there, and his sister plays a pipe organ for our sister, but he got in bad company and he drank too much. Well, you know, I married that guy just 4 months later. I don't have said possibly yet the forbidden fruit, because I went for him in a big way, and he did for me. And I didn't question his drinking. We used to date and go in a horse and buggy. And I remember one incident in particular that should have, had not been for my curiosity, at the end of our courtship. He took me to Connersville, a little town on the other side of Liberty, to a show. And he kept going out, and not only at intermission, but getting loaded. And although I was raised on a farm, well, I didn't know about driving horses to write a book about. And so I started to drive that darn horse home, and he was drunk. And I, in Indiana, they had, I guess it still had some covered bridges. Anyhow, I run the horse into the side of the bridge, and I thought if I ever get home with this guy, well, I'll never look at him again. So next morning I went down the street. All of a sudden, when we got from here to town, he discovered he lost his hat and was determined that I'd go back and hunt that hat. And you can imagine how I told him. Well, anyhow, the next morning I went down the street for my aunt, and I met him, and I sure wasn't going to speak to him, but he had the hat on. And I couldn't resist temptation. I don't mean temptation, I mean curiosity. So I stopped and I asked him what had happened. Some kid had rode in on a bicycle and found it and took it to the livery barn. and that's how I got the hat. So our first hit place was my pastor, although he continued to drink. And he continued to drink after we were married. His people, I know, definitely felt that he married a girl from the wrong side of the track. They were quite his sister's sexually socially inclined. And he was in business with his father. It was Mason and Sons, real estate, Notre Republic. And they used to say there goes poor old John, who was in the Civil War and lost an eye of his father. And he'd be going down the street and he'd hear people say there goes poor old John hunting around. And, but we have two children, and it got worse and worse when he goes to the patio, he's drinking. And I finally left and come back to Arizona where I was born and raised, and I didn't know where he was. I was there a year, and went back to work. I worked before I was 14 in the woolen mills over there, and I got a job back there, and I didn't hear from him for a year. During that year, I went to see an attorney about a divorce, but I couldn't do it. And at the end of the year, about, he wrote a card to the children, and said that I did have a warrant for him for the divorce, and he said he was leaving where that was sent from. But on that card, I shall never forget it, he said, "Tell Mommy I still love her." I think I still have the card. He came back, and he promised me that he wouldn't drink anymore. And I don't know why I should have believed him, because he promised me that thousands of times. But I sort of did believe him, and we went outside the same, we went back together. Went to housekeeping in camp, and he went to work for the telephone company there. And before quite some time, when he was a little bit away, I was sure that he was on another drunk. But I finally got so I fully thought he was cured. I didn't know anything about such a thing as alcoholism, of course. And I trusted him explicitly. We moved to Barberton when the old 40s were still here, and he went to work for the old 40s rubber before traveling took over. And as I said, I never thought of him drinking again. We didn't have much of material things. He didn't make much when he was working for the telephone company, but we had a great deal of happiness. And the children were baptized in the Methodist Church in Kent, and I was too. I've never been baptized. And I done quite a bit of church work, got interested in the church there, and done quite a bit of church work. We came and moved over here to Barberton, and one night, I was fully convinced that he was cured, that he wouldn't drink again, and one night, he went off to a prize fight. In the meantime, the oldest daughter had married and they were living at home. And my son-in-law, and he went to this prize fight. I had no fears of his drinking, but they were pretty late coming home. And when I saw what time it was, I got up and heard my son-in-law, and I said, "Where's Dad?" And he said, "Eastern." He had a peculiar look on his face, and he said, "He's coming." Well, he was on his hands and knees. He was higher than a kite. And at that time, I was totally broken up about it. But I told him that if that was the way he wanted it, that I would never be separated from him until death part of it. And if that's the way he wanted it, that's the way he'd have it. That where he went, I'd go, and when he drank, I'd drink. It didn't turn out to be that way at all, because I had the capacity about six times what he had. And he passed out all the time. It made me furious. And I would leave him, parked in front of the spot where his bosses couldn't help it being propped up in the front seat while I went back in and drank. And at home, he always was passing out on me. And but we were never quarrelsome about our drinking. for about 5 years. I started out in this way, 15 years of drinking, and the first 5 years were pleasant social drinking. We made Prohibition, we made gallons and gallons of homebrew. We never sold a bottle, but we thought we did because we really had games there. You know how it was if you have drinks, why you always had something. Dr. Bob has said many times that 13 years of his sobriety was really a record as far as he was concerned for sobriety without any help to a true alcoholic. And Dr. Bob said there wasn't any question in his mind but whether he was a true alcoholic. It got worse and worse. We had a lovely home up here on Otterbein, and we drank more and more, and he took chances all the time on losing his job. And I think it was about after 5 years of drinking that I was conscious of the fact that I had to. I couldn't go on without that. It was terribly disturbing, and not only disturbing, but I was remorseful, I was ashamed. I thought I must be losing my mind, that I couldn't leave it alone when I wanted to, but I couldn't. We lost this home up here over nothing in the world but drinking, and we moved out where I live now. And then that was terrific. It's a strange thing as much as I drank. I was driven home many times, and if any of you know that is up here, there's a retaining wall in the back, in the alley that went in the back of the garage. And somebody driving me home, I'd be awful drunk. And they couldn't get the car in the garage. They'd be all back and forth, and I, my drunken stupidity, they'd tell them, like, get over it, let me put the car in the garage. And I could do it. We moved out here in the country, and the day we moved out, we got the movers drunk, and they knocked big chunks out of the refrigerator, and I couldn't go on to the company because, oh, it was terrible. I was thinking the other day, do you think after all these years you forget things, but things come back to you, you know. And I was thinking about how it was funny, but the couple we bought the place of came out on Sunday evening, and we moved on Saturday. And the children were out and helped us move the first both of them, and we were gone from home. And we just had an awful glorious time. And, but oh, I was sick. And Ross, as usual, passed out and was in the living room on the dinosaur. And this couple came in to see him. I always have all the ailments, you know. I had either had twinsy if I was first, like I am now. Or I had gallstones. That was one of my favorites. But anyhow, I told them that I thought I was getting pneumonia, that I was sure I was. I couldn't talk very well, and I was sure I had a cancer. They told me afterwards, they got outside and looked at each other, and they said, I don't believe she's got pneumonia. I believe she is drunk. And I walked. But I felt free as a drink out there, and up here on the hill, I had lovely neighbors, and some of them are still my close friends. They always said if I hurt anyone, it was myself, that I was a good wife and mother, and a good neighbor and friend. But I felt freer out there. I thought, well, the list would come, and I would take Mason to work over the side, and I'd done all the driving, and I'd go and get four or five double headers, and I'd be off to the races again. One of the things that I did that I fully appreciated, it made me so darn mad. I'd bring beer home, and I'd want so sure that nobody would hear or see that I had it. Get right in the middle of the backyard, and the bottom would fall out of the bag, and beer would fly all over the backyard. One of these lovely neighbors, though, that I still have after living like that all the time, were deeply concerned for it. And she left me strictly alone, didn't know I was drinking. And when I would get off the one, she never doesn't treat me just lovely. And to this day, they're so interested in AA and interested in my welfare, and they're just wonderful neighbors. But it got worse and worse. Our vacations, I have to tell you a little about that, were the first 2 weeks in September. And, you know, I pity the people that have read this in the book and heard it over and over, but if you want to leave or go to sleep, it's okay by me. They might be somebody who has heard it. And I promised Tommy, sure, that I'd give tonight so he could get it on a tape. So you're suffering for the promise I made to him. But anyhow, these vacations got worse and worse. We used to have good times on them. We always drank. But we'd start on the Saturday before Labor Day. And that's the only time I got in jail. 11 barbers in 2 years after we were in AA. And I said to my husband, Dad, I think we'll tell him about getting in jail tonight. He said, go ahead, I won't lose my job after all this time. And so I told that audience, I said, I'm going to tell you something. And some of the wives who were awfully close and I confided in said they thought she said, what could she possibly be going to tell us? She hadn't already told us. And then they were amused because I made such an awful thing out of it because I'd been picked up for drunk driving. And some of them come to me and said, don't you realize there isn't probably hardly anyone here that one time or another has well, for drunken driving. But down at Del Air, and I was near as drunk as I was lots of times to be driving, but they said they played up between this little house for motorcycle top, and you drove up to the side of them and told me to get over. I didn't know what for. But anyhow, another one took route with him, and I got over and they took us to jail. And I never was in jail before, and I didn't know just exactly what the process was, but they brought me a bottle of coffee and a sandwich, and I told my husband afterward I didn't want there to be jail grub. He said, what do you mean jail grub? He said, they didn't bring me anything, and you'll find out somebody had felt sorry and gone off and got us and brought us. And it was Sunday night, and they called the mayor in and had us before him. And to find me $117 and told us to get out of town. And not only did they tell us to get out of town, but they escorted us out. And I always think it's wonder they didn't really throw me back in because I could really have dignity and be sarcastic when I was drunk. And I got on my high horse and with real dignity told them as they escorted us over the bridge to Wendell. I hope sometime if their wives were visiting an accident, I could extend to them in the same hospital. It extended to me. And boy, I was sarcastic about it. It's a wonder they didn't throw me right back in. We went over in Wheaton and put up at a motel and stayed drunk for a week. And even the bartenders were anxious about it. Come out and glaring headlines, first woman drunk driver that they picked up in Del Air, my name. And go to these bars over it. We laugh about it, see it in the paper, you know, laying on the bar. And they say to me, you gotta get out of here. That picks you up again. They don't really rap you. But when the money was gone, while we headed for home, like poor dogs just hang their tail behind them because we knew that a sideline heard that or found it out that we'd be fired. We went up to my daughter's and pretty sheepishly and get it around, but no one had heard of St. Taylor. Well, that was that day. The next vacation, I broke this arm, and my husband didn't drive, and that was just down West Virginia. I drove into Washington, down Pennsylvania Avenue with my arm in a cast, and high in 17 sites, and you know what traffic is in Washington, and stayed there at that tank for about a week. And from home. Well, the next vacation, we decided we'd really be sensible and stay home and take the house. So on Saturday, I got drunk and set the house on fire and we didn't have to. Well, that was the last one before we found AA. My husband saw on a paper where Raul Hemsley had found something that he'd gone on the wagon. And he read it and kind of laughed and thinking about it. But we were both thinking, I was thinking at the time, and he was thinking that maybe some way that could help us, whatever it was. But after he read that sometime, I was in a bar with a terrific hangover. I couldn't get the drink to my mouth. I had a jitter, so I was tipping it off the bar, and you can imagine how ashamed I was. car. There's a man standing there watching me, and I'm so ashamed to have him see me like that. And I said to him, and I always, when I was deeply ashamed, instead of acting like I was, why, I'd be real cocky. And I said to him, I'll have to join that darn day business if I keep on like this. So he said, well, sister, I can get you in a, he said, you have to have a password. And he said, I'll find out what the password is now. And he said, but if you think you're nuts now, he said, they roll on the floor and holler. I said, well, to myself, that completely turned me away from any thought of ever accepting that help. Because I thought, well, I might as well be nuts drunk as nuts sober. And so again, well, I'm that I did, but it went on for worse and worse. One incident that happened when we were living up here on the hill, I was thinking about telling you some of this piece tonight. My mother died, and her sister being left alone, she was a very fine typewriter. She wanted to study with John's house that winter and came out here and studied, went to Ashland and studied further with him. And did we have a time? The reason I tell you this is it goes to show, no matter how hard you try, or how important it is, that you do keep that. Finally, you're going to have a drink. And we knew we were going to have to be awful careful when we knew she was coming, because nobody would see her against anything to drink. So my sister and my brother and his wife came in from out of town that morning early. It was near Christmas. And she was coming for the Christmas first. And so we all got to drinking, and we had bottles under the Chinese table. My granddaughter was a little top 10. We all got to the table, and of course, she couldn't help it, though we were all drinking. But she just down to play with the baby, and you should have heard the bottles rattling and jiggling around under there. Well, another thing I thought of, when we went to station to meet her, how idiotic she can be. I turned around and looked and wondered how around she was making out, because I needed some drugs to get out and walk. Here he comes, driving along with a little light hat knock in his hand like this, and her carrying two heavy shoes. And he had this cool grin on his face. Well, he really got her to go lifetime, because we tried to hide it, but we couldn't. We had that as a drinking. Well, one night we got to drinking. I went off and got a fifth. Russ was down his workshop in the basement, and I took it down, and we were real quiet about killing it. But that sent us off the first. So I took him up to my daughter's and put him to bed, and her husband and I went out for some more. And I remember this incident. We were at the tap room, and I was the drunk. I ran into that where he came out under that bridge, and he came out of the side door to the tap room. And that was a finish for this old maid sister of his. She said she heard everything. She heard somebody going out drinking with their son-in-law. That was it. And my poor daughter, she played honeydew bridge with her all night, trying to keep her interested. But it just goes to show that no matter how hard we try, that urge is there, and it's got to be. But the reason she went home, she never came back to the week after we was in AA. And this went on. Then I decided that we better get them on this awful drunk for over 2 weeks. And I better tell this little escapade because a dear friend of mine is in the audience. And I belong to this club with her and some other ladies. And they were all so sober and so decent. And I so wanted to impress them that I was. And if you'd ever know what I went through trying to keep it from them, that I drank. And because I live in the country, they all live in town. Well, they decided one morning to surprise me. And they all would bring covered dish lights for the dinner time. But they thought it would be nice to go to the country and take breakfast to surprise me. And boy, did I have a hangover that But she tells me that I kept it from them. But I told them it was the first year we were in AA, and I told them that, I bragged to them at talk meeting about this lovely banquet we were going to attend in Akron on the following Sunday. And I didn't tell them how it was. And on Monday night at the Mountain Beacon, 500 ex-drunks came to the hotel Sattler, and I thought I'd die. And I called Ann Smith, and I said, that was when she was drunk. I said, Ann, what do I do? What do I tell him? She said, I don't know. So I just like to come clean and tell them the truth. But they never knew that I was, Perlis told me they never knew that I was like that, near as bad as I was. But I only saw him once a month, so I had a pretty good chance there. But she's probably hearing things tonight that she never dreamed of that happened to me, that's for sure. So finally, as I say, it got worse and worse. And, I thought something's got to be done. And we've been on this awful drug. And I once before, I had a hangover and was down at the bar in another place. And this woman told me that her husband could help us. And he belonged to something in Akron, that he was a heavy drinker and he had joined this. And they could help about the drinking. And I thought right away, that crazy bunch the other guy told me about, I don't want that. But we finally come to it, that we reached a place that we've got to have help. And so I after being on this terrific drug, I got in the car and reaching all the way, went down there and asked her if her husband could help me. And she said, yes, he's sending over. So that night, Jack Millard, who many of you know, came and brought two cans of beer, one to each other, about 10 o'clock at night. And that was, it'll be 22 years, the next 8th May. And it's a wonder we didn't go into D.C., because that's all we had to drink. And he went in town to see Dr. Smith, but Dr. Smith was in Florida. And he came down here to clinic, and one of the doctors at the clinic sent out some pills. But if you think you talk about suffering now, what I mean, we suffered it out. Some of my sponsors at first, there were no women to come, and these men came out, and they impressed me so greatly, their appearance. They were so clean and well-dressed, and seemed so happy. They all had nice cars. I said to Dad one day, they probably, the neighbors say, the old fool must have, one of them died. The word of her is all these nice cars, you know. And they talked to us about a Jack Millard dropped a Saturday evening post to Jack Alexander's at that art plan. And they really, those men really talked AA to us. And we were so delighted that there was some hope for us, because we had given up so we thought there was no hope for us. I said to these men, I will do anything in the world if you can show me how to stay safe. And they said there are just very simple things to do that are just seem to do it. And they told us about going to the meeting. I would get that I just want a drink, and the awful mother. And I had no religious background. They told me to read the Sermon on the Mount. Dr. Smith told me the first bucket and a half I saw rolling uphill here, Sermon on the Mount. I have it with autograph, because he got thought I'd never see the bucket and a half and gave it to me. I have that well, looked well marked. But I really found my God, as I understand it, in that garden. When I got so upset, I would take the hole and go to that garden and work until I think I'd drop over. But I would talk to him in my simple way, as I talk to him now, because that's the easiest way for me. And I also felt that I built up spiritual strength to face what I had to face. We had a marvelous time. We accepted it in perfect accord, as we drank in perfect accord. We had very few quarrels. My husband would take his bottle and went on the Danforth, and I'd take mine and go to bed, and I'd always kill mine, and he'd have a couple of shots and pass off. I'd go drink his and try to impress him with the fact he drank, and he never impressed. He knew he didn't. And he'd say, well, Ma, we'll just have to go and get another. And but we practiced at this program. We were very fortunate to have Doc and Annie They started, I don't think they missed a week during the first week of our sobriety, being at our house and spending the evening and maybe dropping by and coming, having a bite to eat with us. And at that time, we were very, as many of the old timers can tell you, we were very close. If anyone was missing at the meeting, why, we investigated to find out if they were in trouble, or if they were ill, or if they were drunk, sometimes it happened, but they didn't let us know that people quit. It was a long time before we knew that people said that it wasn't 100%. But after about 3 years of this, well, the first year, we never missed a Wednesday night of the school. It was just a must, and we loved it. And then my husband got sick. He had a heart condition. And the doctor told him he was going to die. And that I thought that I had made a complete surrender. I had tried off as hard to. I made such a lousy end of my life that I felt that if I did make a complete surrender, that it would be this wonderful and it would have, but I haven't. Because when he told me that he couldn't live, I tried to bargain with this God that I found and tell him not to do that to me, that I couldn't. But he let him live nearly a year longer than he had expected. And in that time, I never became completely resigned to losing him. But I think I did. I had time enough to pray enough and to know it's just God's will. I think the mom's lecture that I've never taken again. My husband stays with me. But he never once during that time said to me, "Mother, you'll never drink again." And he knew so well that day at a time program of ours that he wouldn't have said never anyway. But he had such explicit faith in me, evidently, that he never thought I would. And I think if I were to take a drink before I could get it to my mouth, his face would come before me, and I don't think I could take it. But it's been a lonely 18 years, but a good 18 years. My husband was buried on Friday, and they told me there were a couple of women up in St. Thomas, a couple of alcoholic women, and I knew I was carry on. I knew the only salvation that I could possibly have was to carry on with this program. And I went up to see those women and sat down beside one of their beds. I went on Sunday afternoon and I wept. And I was so sorry because I thought I shouldn't have come. But that woman told me many times that that was the surest proof for her that this really worked. But then I had buried my beloved on Friday, and I was up there trying to help her on Sunday. So we never know how these things react on people that we try to help. Each individual case, because every night when I was in Mansfield, I remember a meeting I led down there a long time ago, and they asked me, somebody in the audience, what was my daily program. And I thought they meant when did I eat and sleep? Because I don't have a daily program like some people have. I suppose I shouldn't say that, but I pray when I feel a need of prayer. And I've always loved going to meetings, and I do want to stress the importance of them. And above all, trying to help the other person. Because in doing that, it's bound to keep us sober. I pray different than a lot of people, because just as I pray different out in that garden that I made. Many times when I'm driving, and I don't so much now, but I used to drive a lot, my prayers were old-fashioned hymns, even that I said. And even now, when I don't see very good, sometimes I sing to you, Savior, pilot me, and I'm sure he's going to do it. And, it's hard for me to talk to you folks about what my AA program has been, because I don't suppose there's anyone in this world that has kept the AA program any simpler than I have. If it were complicated in any way, I'm too dumb, I'd have never got it. And one day when Dr. and Pam were out the house, And Doc and I would help me make coffee with Kitchen Man was in the living room. And I never forgot this. Either he said, look up that thing he said that. You know, I thought he said, you believe all of this is simply a little child, don't you? He said, the spiritual child and the program, the way it works, he said, why, it's just childish, really. And so refreshing. And I said to him, man, yes, Dr. Bob, if it was any other way, I probably never would have grasped it. And so I keep to try to keep your personal program as simple as you possibly can, because it's so much easier that way. You know, I don't do this very often, as most of you know. This is Thanksgiving, and I know that our hearts are filled with gratitude. Mine certainly is tonight, as it is every day. But I will take this opportunity to touch my talk chart in order to give everybody an opportunity not to praise me, please believe me, but to express their gratitude for what God has done for them. And I think when I look out on a audience, large or small, I think the biggest one I ever faced was there were 2,000 at Toronto. And you look at those faces, and it's just hard to express what it does to you, because it's hidden on me, those happy faces, but it's how many people are touched by that one person's surprise. And so on this day that I talked to Barbara and tried to, I want the wives to feel free. If they want to say what they're grateful for or that they are grateful, I want them to have a part in that. An OGF is definitely a church. Somebody will ask me anyhow, and I hate it. But and this was an escapade, and about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, there was a young man laying here, and it was a scream because he didn't know I was in the house. And he talked about that woman that took the turkey to bed. And I stood back there, but he didn't know. And this turkey business was... I told George Montgomery that once in confidence, and I threw some in, because I was ashamed of it, and he just broadcasted it. But I went in, the children didn't have their car, and I went in and got my daughter and her husband and the little girl for Christmas. And they helped trim the tree. And then we had a lot of booze, of course, for Christmas over the Christmas. And my son-in-law and I got in an argument. He called some people to come and get them. And of course, I was brokenhearted because I wanted my granddaughter there for Christmas. So I took the tree and all the trimmings and pitched it down the base of the step. And then I had the turkey all stuffed and ready to roast. And you know what? I never come through for about 5 days. And when I did, I found a carpet for the turkey under the head of my bed. And I had evidently baked it and fought all this kind of stuff. I had grease in my hair, my ears, all over the bed. And I want to tell you that that was a mess. And just as sure as I don't end up, one of the boys remarked about when I came in about Jack, I guess, the ball of story. One night, I got a lot of them. Trying to pick a duck and trying everything in the world with it and drinking a couple of quarts while I was picking the darn duck, and then I got the idea to smear butter over it and just brown the bug. But anyhow, then somebody kept asking about these fowls that story. Well, I'm tell about the time I set the chickens in the house. My sister was coming to dinner, and I got awful drunk, and I had to have a drink, and I left. And I said, I got 3 big white chickens and brought in the house. Oh, I said, I just wanted to know that my intentions were good. I got those chickens in the house. never come back till night, and it took me a week to sing that song. She said that when they came, one chicken was roosted on the foot of the bed, and one in a big lounge chair. So they kept calling about me telling about these stories, and I said, no foul stories tonight. And after that, I heard some women giggling at the So that's all the foul stories I'm going to tell you. I'm going to leave you go for that. I think that's better. Okay, now.